WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When a person turns violent and opens fire on people at work, kills a spouse, or rapes a stranger, that violence usually doesn't come out of nowhere, according to my guest Gavin DeBecker. He's in the business of predicting who is likely to become violent or follow through on a threat. He consults on stalkers, death threats, domestic violence, and violence in the workplace. His clients have included Supreme Court justices, movie stars, athletes, elected officials, abortion clinics, corporations, and police departments. He's also served on the Presidential Advisory Board at the Department of Justice. DeBecker is the author of the bestseller, The Gift of Fear, which offers advice on protecting yourself from violence. It was recently published in paperback. When we spoke last year, he told me he can't advise people to always comply with an attacker or to always resist. Every situation is different. What he does advise is trust your intuition. I asked him why.
Well, because like every creature on earth, you've got this astounding God-given ability to protect your own safety, to know when you're in the presence of danger. And your intuition takes all the advice. The people who said always comply, always resist, the newspaper article you read, the story you heard from a friend, the advice you saw on the local news, it takes it all and applies it in the only context that really matters, which is the context of the situation you find yourself in then and there.
Do you feel that people act on their intuition without even realizing that they're acting on it?
Many people do, and certainly we act on our fear without realizing that we're really doing it and without thinking about it first. I hope that my work gives people permission to listen to it more often without debate, because the other side of that coin is people hesitate to listen to it. And, you know, while we're cleverly defying our intuition, we're ending up as very frequent victims of violence and accidents.
You have a lot of, I think, really interesting signs to watch out for, signs that you're actually being set up by somebody, and they're kind of trying to assess whether you'll be a good victim or not, and they're trying to set you up to be their victim. I want to run through some of these warning signs, which I think are really interesting. You call one of them forced teaming. What is this?
Well, all of these strategies are strategies of persuasion, and they're used by predatory criminals, and they're also used by other people in different contexts. But if it is used on a woman in a vulnerable situation or a situation where she is alone with someone that she doesn't know or doesn't want to be with, then they're all real important to know about. And forced teaming is basically giving someone or trying to give them the impression that we share a predicament together so that we have a kind of we're in the same boat attitude. An example would be, hey, aren't we a pair both stuck here in the rain without an umbrella? Well, I would hope a victim would say, or think at least, you don't have an umbrella, and I don't have an umbrella. There's no we don't have an umbrella. And there's a story in the book of a man who says, hey, we've got a hungry cat upstairs, because he sees that a woman has cat food in her shopping bag. And in fact, you know, I have a cat, and you may have a cat, but we don't have a hungry cat. He does that because it will make it harder for a woman to rebuff him when there is this sense of some shared experience or we're in the same boat kind of experience.
I know I've been in a position sometimes of like turning down somebody who wanted to do a favor because I distrusted this stranger's motives. And the stranger can come back at you with something like, oh, you're just like too stuck up to accept a favor, or boy, you're the most untrusting person I've ever met. And you
right.
don't know how to respond to that. Should you start being, you know, nicer because you've just been insulted and maybe you have unfairly dismissed somebody's courtesy?
Well, that's certainly what he is trying to do. That strategy is called typecasting, and it's where you give a woman a small insult that she can fix easily. Like an example would be saying, you're probably too fancy a woman to go out with a guy like me. And now to prove that you're not too fancy a woman, then you'll continue to talk to somebody who you might otherwise not want to talk to, or somebody who says, you don't seem like the kind of woman who reads the newspaper, and now a woman may feel like, oh, I have to show him how smart I am. And what I tell people is that the nature of those little insults or typecasting is, you know, as a predatory strategy, he is just trying to continue and extend the encounter. And you may win the little point, of demonstrating to him that, no, you actually do read the newspaper, but you lose the bigger war, which is that you still have someone in your environment who you don't want in your environment.
There's something you call loan sharking.
Yes, loan sharking is probably the most common strategy and the one that people are most familiar with. That is basically offering to help someone when they didn't ask for help, so that they then owe you at least the courtesy of continuing to talk to you. I mean, the typical example is, can I help you with those groceries? And then whether or not you accept the help, I've done this nice thing, so you can't be rude to me now by rebuffing me or by excluding me from conversation. And it's another one of the strategies that is used all the time to extend the encounter and give a predatory criminal the opportunity to evaluate the situation and, above all, evaluate you.
Women so often don't want to be rude. And I mean, sometimes on a bus or a train, someone will sit down next to you who's frightening to you even, and you won't change your seat because you figure, well, this person might be a very nice, unfortunate person, and you'd be being rude. What advice do you have to women who may actually be putting themselves in jeopardy by being polite?
Well, rudeness is so relative. You know, what I hope to do is to give people a whole new way to think about that, because people are so concerned that being rude might make a man angry, you know, reasoning that they could turn someone whose intent was favorable into someone dangerous just by not being open to their discussions or their approach. And I'm glad to tell people that it is impossible in the context of an unwanted approach from a stranger to transform an ordinary, decent man into a rapist or a killer. And then on the other side, thankfully, it is possible to transform yourself into a person who responds to the signals and thus is a less likely victim. You know, we teach kids now that a stranger who approaches you is a problem. And I want to teach adults that a stranger who approaches a woman in a remote area is himself doing something rude, because it is known, it is predictable, that that would cause her discomfort or fear. The approach is rude. So in context, it's not rude to say to somebody, hey, I'd rather not talk.
You know, you talk about relying on your intuition, but I think there are times when you might confuse intuition with deeply ingrained stereotyping or racism. And you might find yourself in an encounter with somebody who is of a different ethnic group or race or religion than you, and you feel like, oh, you intuitively distrust this person, when what's really happening is that you're just acting on deeply ingrained racist feelings that you were brought up with. And you don't want that to happen.
No, it's a great point. And what I hope people come away with here is that demographics are absolutely irrelevant to safety. Demographics are for pollsters and odds makers. It makes no difference to you in the situation you're in whether the person whose behavior concerns you is black or white. No difference whatsoever. What matters is that you can see the pre-incident indicators. You can see the signals that human beings send each other prior to violence and as part of violent encounters. And it is about predicting human behavior, not demographics. And it's a very good point you raise, because people do have in their minds all sorts of information from things they saw on the local TV news that aren't necessarily relevant to their circumstance and the context of their situation. We may say, oh, well, this is one of those demographic groups that's more likely to hurt me. But while you're thinking about the, you know, the black man who may hurt you, and you're focused on that, you will fail to see the strategies of the white or Hispanic or Oriental person whose behavior is the issue.
I think that behavior is in some ways getting really hard to predict. For instance, you say that, like, if you're a woman walking alone and you feel like somebody might be following you, instead of furtively turning your head and giving them a kind of hidden glance to see if there's really somebody there or not, you should turn around and stare the person in the face in this really no-nonsense way. I would argue, though, that then you risk this person feeling like you've dissed them in some way. And, you know, how many times do you read in the paper or hear about on the news somebody who shot somebody because of the look that they were given?
Well, the fact is that many people who act out violently use as their excuse later on, that person was rude to me, or that person did such and such, which is a way of not taking responsibility for one's action. There's nothing that I could do to you with a look that would justify my being killed. But with regard to your question, really I don't recommend that people turn around and stare at someone. What I do is recommend that you turn your head completely, take in everything, and look squarely at someone who concerns you, because it not only gives you information, but it communicates to him that you're not a tentative, frightened, you know, victim in waiting. I want to tell people that you are an animal of nature that's fully endowed with hearing and sight and intellect, and that you're not easy prey, so don't act tentative like easy prey. I do not, however, recommend staring someone down by any measure, just looking at them and taking in the information. And there is clearly a provocation that comes from staring at people. I mean, with a look alone, I could get into a fight with another man. And that's not what I'm recommending. But I am recommending don't be tentative, look fully at someone so they know you see them.
Do you think that people should carry mace to protect themselves?
Well, mace is a product name for a particular kind of tear gas. If one is going to carry that type of, these are irritants that, you know, burn the eye and the face and affect the breathing, I prefer pepper spray, which is a better product in my opinion, in that it works on a wider number of people in the population. I think it's a perfectly good thing. It gives you a slight advantage of removing someone's ability to see, and it causes a great deal of discomfort, and it's non-lethal. So I certainly don't oppose pepper spray.
If somebody is obviously addled because they're high on drugs, do you think that it's easy to assess what their behavior is going to be, or are all bets off there?
Well, I don't think in any circumstance all bets are off, because really if someone is in your environment who is a stranger, who makes you feel uncomfortable, and who's also high on drugs or alcohol, your prediction is done. Now it's a matter of what strategies you apply, but the element of predicting human behavior couldn't be any easier than when you have somebody in your environment who causes you discomfort and is high or drunk.
But I mean in terms of deciding whether you should comply or find any way to run for your life, even if that person is threatening you with your life if you try to flee.
Well, it usually isn't a decision, interestingly, Terry. One of the premises of my work is that fear, true fear, which is the signal that occurs in the presence of danger, is a gift because it guides people through dangerous situations. I mean, I've got case after case of people who did extraordinary things, even literally a man who fights with a great white shark and wins on the basis of doing what fear told him without decision making. So many people talk about having completed their self-defense strategy, whatever it was, without even thinking about it. And there's a woman who tells me about following a man who would murder her silently down the hall. He doesn't know that she's behind him. And she told me later, I was a passenger moving on my own legs. I had nothing to do with it. Because fear says, in effect, shut up and do what I say and don't debate. And it's usually the strategies when it's true fear are over before people get to the decision-making mode. It's smarter than we are, in other words.
My guest is Gavin De Becker, author of The Gift of Fear. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Gavin De Becker, an expert on how to protect yourself against the threat of violence. You've consulted with many people about stalkers. When do you typically get called in on a stalker case? How far has the situation usually progressed by the time you're called in?
I think the cornerstone characteristic of a case that involves our office is fear. When a victim feels in fear for their safety, that's usually when we're called, unless it's a prominent public figure, in which case they are often already clients because they are experiencing so many cases, and really there our chore is to identify which cases rise to the level of concern and which cases don't. But usually people involve our office when they are afraid.
Does the stalker typically want to be known or want to be invisible?
Both, depending on which type. I think there's a bold line that we can draw between two types of stalkers. Those that pursue media figures, which are the ones we read about often in the paper, and those that pursue regular people. And talking about those that pursue regular people, they are not usually attention seekers. They are usually attachment seekers. And, the most common form of stalking is by estranged ex-husbands or people in relationships. And I know Americans are fascinated when a public figure is attacked by a stalker, but that happens about once every 3.5 years. A woman is murdered by a stalking ex-husband or ex-boyfriend once every 2 hours in America. And that's why you'll see in my work a great deal more focus on those kinds of stalking cases than on the ones that generally are interesting to the news media.
Well, if you're being stalked by an ex-husband or boyfriend or something, then the idea of ignore them and they'll go away is not going to work for you.
That's absolutely correct. I think if you are at a circumstance with an ex-husband or an ex-boyfriend where the pre-incident indicators that are associated with escalations of violence or even homicide are present, then you're in a situation where you need to make yourself unavailable to your pursuer, and there are many strategies for doing that. None of them are easy. The problem is we want someone to tell us, oh, it'll be all right, which is what our denial is telling us very often. And so, literally several times every day, women are murdered in America who knew full well that they were in danger of being killed, but took advice that was easier to take than going to a battered women's shelter, which is really usually the thing to do if you're in a situation where you have a real safety hazard.
How effective do you think restraining orders are?
Well, I think it's a real serious part of this problem because if you went to a doctor and he said you've got to have immediate heart surgery because your life is in danger, or you can carry this piece of paper, of course, most people would say, oh, I'll take the piece of paper, doc. But where we are with a lot of these cases is that some of them involve women who are in immediate danger and their life is at risk, and yet they take a strategy which is the one that sounds simple and easy, carry this piece of paper. The fact is this, based on as many studies as I've been able to locate, about 2/3 of cases improve after getting restraining orders. About 1/3 do not improve, and in that population there are some that escalate to homicide. So it's very, very important that anybody who has the opportunity to communicate with potential victims makes this point clear. Restraining orders are right for some cases, very wrong for some cases, and the challenge is to know which kind of case yours is.
Is that what your job is?
Absolutely. Both my job in my work and in my work with, I'm the co-chair of the Domestic Violence Council Advisory Board, and my job in public education, which I'm doing that job right now, is to make clear that restraining orders are right for some cases, very wrong for others, and to identify the characteristics associated with where it'll help. And the answer is usually resides in the victim, which is asking the victim, how do you think he's going to react to this? And if the victim says, I think he's going to be afraid to be arrested and he's going to leave me alone forever, then that's the right strategy. But if the victim says, I think he's going to react angrily and possibly escalate, then it is the wrong strategy. And we've got a country now that is recommending restraining orders wholesale, 1,000 a day issued in the United States. And news agencies and local news always saying, here's how you get a restraining order if you're being stalked, instead of, should you get a restraining order if you're being stalked? Because it's not right for every case.
Do you think it's as simple as asking the person who's being stalked what they think the impact of the restraining order will be on their spouse or boyfriend?
No, it's not as simple as that, but that person, in that person resides the best information in terms of intuition. And then there are about 40 other things that I talk about that one would measure in these cases to determine if a restraining order is the best strategy. The real problem is that we can't, and yet we do, too often diagnose a situation on the basis of one characteristic. I mean, can you imagine if a caller called in and said, I have chest pains, would any doctor in the world say, oh, okay, here's what you do, and give a prescription or a treatment plan? Yet, ironically, women are calling, radio shows and police departments and lawyers all over the country and saying, I'm being stalked by my angry ex-husband. What should I do? And people are actually willing to give a treatment plan without a diagnosis. And that's why women every day are being killed, and in their, personal effects is a restraining order. So clearly it's not right for every case.
I'm wondering, because you deal with so many violent people, do you walk out of your house and just see the potential violent person wherever you are? Are you always picking that person out whose behavior is cluing you that they might erupt?
Terry, it's a good question, but the answer is it's literally the opposite. I am blessed to live a fairly fear-free life because my philosophy about fear is that it is a signal that will sound in the presence of danger. So I needn't invent, nor have worry or anxiety about things that might happen. You know, people who are focused on what might happen instead of what is happening tend to not only be more anxious and have a lot more worry and anxiety in their lives, but also less safe. Because if you're saying, gee, somebody could climb out from behind that bush or behind that car, you're not perceiving what's actually going on. And unwarranted fear will kill more Americans this year than violence will. Striking to say, I know, but the fact is there is more fear in America than there is danger. And what I've really focused on in my work is how you tell the difference between true fear, which you want, that's a survival signal in the presence of danger, and unwarranted fear, which is anxiety and worry and all of those things that you don't want. And in this culture, it's very, very hard to do because the local news is selling us a diet of all the ways we might die and the urgency, you know, with which they tell us you must learn this information.
Gavin De Becker, he's the author of The Gift of Fear, which was recently published in paperback.